I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's December 21st, and we have a lot to talk about. And before we get into today's episode, I want to wish each of you a very happy holiday season. Whether you celebrated Hanukkah a few weeks ago, or you're looking forward to Christmas or Kwanzaa, or maybe it's the winter solstice, or maybe you're just happy to see that 2021 is coming to an end, and you're looking forward to better things in 2022. I hope you're making the most of the season and finding only good things. For me, the holiday season always seems like a good time for reflection, for looking back and looking ahead. And today, we're revisiting two of the most important conversations that we've had this year on Real Talk MS. First, I want to share a replay of the conversation I had with Dr. Mitzi Joy Williams about racial and ethnic disparities in MS. The year 2021 will be remembered as a year when events forced our country to look at itself in the mirror and acknowledge that in many different ways, not every American was being afforded the same opportunities, nor were they being treated equally. For the MS community, it meant examining the inequities in the way healthcare is accessed and delivered. It was the admission that clinical research needs to be more diverse, because evidence shows that MS affects African Americans and members of the Hispanic and Latinx communities differently than it affects white people. And it was understanding that still today, there are some doctors in some areas of this country who tell their patients that multiple sclerosis is a disease that only affects white women. My conversation with Dr. Williams is a very small part of a larger conversation that we, as part of a larger community, are still having. And there's plenty more work to be done here. But conversations like this one get us a small step closer to creating a better world for all of us. In a moment, we'll hear a replay of my conversation with Dr. Mitzi Joy Williams. Looking at the nearly 1 million people who are living with MS in the United States, you might conclude that MS doesn't discriminate. After all, it impacts people of all ages, all sexual orientations, all ethnic backgrounds. However, when you drill down a bit further and look at things like having access to quality care, and even looking at the course of the disease itself, well, that statement starts appearing less true. My guest today is Dr. Mitzi Joy Williams, and we're talking about some of the disparities that impact members of minority populations who are living with MS. Dr. Williams is a board-certified neurologist and multiple sclerosis specialist who's passionate about educating and empowering people affected by MS to understand the disease process and the goals of treatment. Dr. Williams is a sought-after consultant, speaker, researcher, and author, and she's an expert in understanding MS in underserved and minority populations. Dr. Williams collaborates with national and international committees to advocate for people living with MS, and she's dedicated to raising awareness about the importance of research participation and encouraging diversity in clinical research. Well, welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Williams.
Thank you so much for having me, John. It's my pleasure.
When I think about the various disparities that affect members of minority populations who are living with MS, I see them falling into one of two categories. There are the disparate aspects of the disease course itself, the way that MS impacts members of minority communities differently. And then there are the systemic or institutional inequities that create extra and significant burden for members of minority communities. So let's talk about those disease-related disparities first. Are there some clinical characteristics of MS that are different in Black, Hispanic, or Latinx people?
Absolutely. So some of the differences that we see are mostly affected when we're talking about outcomes. So we see more disability in both of these populations over time. For Black people, we see a faster progression from relapsing MS to secondary progressive MS. We also see more motor dysfunction or walking disability, where Black people can have to use a cane or walker to walk up to 6 to 10 years earlier than their white counterparts. So when we look at other measures such as visual dysfunction, we see worse visual problems as well as more lesions on MRI. So across the board, we see potentially worse outcomes in both of these groups.
Is the proportion of MS subtypes like relapsing or progressive MS, are they also different in minority groups?
So the proportion of subtypes seems to be similar. However, there is a faster progression from relapsing to secondary progressive MS in the Black population. But overall, it doesn't appear that Black or Hispanic Latinx communities have more progressive disease from the start. The subtypes are very similar in that regard.
And what about the onset of MS? Are there differences in age among members of minority populations when it comes to the initial onset of MS?
Absolutely. So the age in Hispanic Latinx communities is slightly younger, so mid-30s or so. And then the age in the African-American community, there's some reports that say it's slightly older, a couple of years older than their white counterparts versus some studies say a little bit younger. But there's several that say the age is a little bit older in the Black population.
So when onset is seen as a couple of years later, as people are a little older when they're diagnosed with MS, do you think that's a function of barriers to diagnosis, or is it disease behavior itself?
That's a great question. And it certainly could be delayed to diagnosis because many people who actually are eventually diagnosed with MS often report symptoms in their teenage years. And for African Americans, because of some of those health barriers and institutional barriers, including systemic racism as well as bias within the medical system, MS may not be thought of as a possible diagnosis for people presenting with clear symptoms of MS. So that certainly could delay diagnosis and maybe why they're diagnosed at a later age.
Speaking of presenting with clear symptoms of MS, a foundational aspect of making that diagnosis and then following MS in a patient is an MRI exam. Have any differences been identified in MRI imaging among members of minority populations?
Yes. So often there is a larger burden of disease. So when we think about lesions related to MS, it's not really helpful to count them because two spots could mean two small spots, or could mean one huge spot and one small spot, or two huge spots. So it's important for us to think about how much of the brain space, how much is being taken up by spots. And that's what we call lesion volume. And so in Black patients, there are higher lesion volumes in the brain. There also is more involvement of the spinal cord, which is what I call expensive real estate, meaning there is a lot of function packed into a really small area. So one spot in the spinal cord can make you not be able to walk, whereas you could get multiple spots in the brain and not have any symptoms related to them.
And what about disease-modifying therapies? Have any DMTs been shown to be more or less effective for members of minority populations?
So we don't really have enough data to tell us. When we talk about our clinical trials, we have very low numbers of minorities who are enrolled in clinical trials. So an average of anywhere from maybe 5 to 8% for Hispanic Latinx communities. There are some studies that suggest up to 16% for Black communities, but the majority of them have about 1 to 2%. So we're talking anywhere from 10 people out of a major clinical trial, which usually has thousands of people, to maybe 30 or 40. And so it's very difficult to make generalizations based on 30 or 40 people. I think that, one of the reasons that we want to push to increase diversity in clinical trials is so that we can better understand if our treatments are effective. From the studies that we do have available, many of which are what we call retrospective, so we take a look backward at a population, it seems like the ones where we do have evidence of larger numbers of African Americans in Hispanic Latinx communities, that the treatment effectiveness is similar across the groups, but we really need clinical trials to answer that question.
And speaking of clinical trials, why do you think minority participation is so underrepresented in clinical trials, and I'll make it a two-part question. How do we fix that?
Yeah. So there are a lot of reasons. And again, I think it's so important to make sure that we talk about enrollment versus participation, because when we say there's a lack of participation, it really puts the onus on the patient, like they are the problem. And although there are patient barriers, such as mistrust of the medical system, you know, there's a long history, especially within the Black community, of unethical studies that have been done in the past and even into the 20th century. And so, you know, mistrust is an issue, as well as access to care. So you have to have access to a site that's running clinical trials. And also, we think about institutional barriers, your doctor has to ask you. So if we think about implicit bias, many providers are not asking people of color to be involved. Also, when we think about institutional barriers, a couple of the major ones are inclusion and exclusion criteria. So the criteria for the studies are so strict and so narrow that if you're a person of color who has comorbidities like diabetes, hypertension, you may be automatically excluded from some of these trials, even if your conditions are well controlled. And then finally, we look at the sites where studies are done. Our industry partners do have a responsibility to be intentional about the places where they choose to do studies and try to reach out to communities that have access to minority populations and also to increase the diversity of our researchers. So some of the ways that we can address that are dealing with those problems, making sure we establish trust, making sure we explain the research process, and making sure that people understand that even though they consent to being in the study, if something happens and they want to come out, they absolutely retain all of their rights to exit a study. On the provider side, we have to train about implicit bias and the importance of asking diverse people to be involved in clinical research. And as our institutions and industry partners, they have to be intentional about the way they design studies so that they can be more inclusive, and also about the places where they seek to do research to make sure that we're including diverse populations of people and diverse investigators who can reach those people.
You know, I think there's a certain irony when you talk about the sites of these clinical studies where research is actually being conducted. It sometimes strikes me as funny that some, not all, but some of the major academic institutions that are sites for clinical trials are actually located in the midst of urban areas, not far from that underserved population, the minority populations that we've been discussing. And yet it seems in their recruitment, we still don't see those populations represented.
Absolutely. And I think the key word is that we have to be intentional. We have to be intentional from the start. You know, when we are creating and designing research, we have to be intentional to say, these are the goals that we're trying to achieve. These are the people that we want to reach, and make sure that that's communicated to all of the communities involved. And again, if we're not getting the results that we need, then let's go to different places to try to get different results.
When we talk about the social determinants of health, what does that mean?
Social determinants of health are really factors that affect health outcomes that don't have to do actually with your physical health. So things like access to certain physicians, how far do you live from medical treatment facilities? Are you do you have transportation to get to those appointments? Do you have access to technology, especially in this age of telemedicine? If we are trying to do telemedicines to make it more convenient, but you have poor internet access or you don't know how to use the different technologies, we're still not able to reach people. So it's all of those factors that lead, that could potentially lead to good or bad health outcomes that don't physically have to do with your physical health.
What about access to care? What are some of the barriers that members of minority populations who are living with MS face when accessing healthcare? And are there any differences in how people with MS from within these communities go about accessing healthcare?
So absolutely. So there are several studies that suggest that minority communities, number one, for general neurologic problems, have less access to a neurologist. But there are also specific studies that suggest that African Americans have less access to a neurologist if they have MS. And so we're talking just a general neurologist. And, you know, of course, there are many great general neurologists who are caring for those who have MS. But we're not even talking about subspecialty care. We're not even talking about a specialty center. So there are people who are being cared for by their primary care physicians, may not have access to certain therapies. And so this is a huge issue. Also, socioeconomic status has a lot to do with access to care. You have to be able to take a day or a half day off of work to go see your doctor. You have to, if you are severely disabled, your family member may have to take a day off to go and take you to see the doctor. You have to pay for parking. You know, so there's so many factors that we think of. So just because you physically can be on a roll at a doctor's office does not necessarily mean that you actually have access to care.
You know, one of my listeners shared with me that it took much longer, years longer, for her to be diagnosed with MS because her doctor, and this was someone who lived in a more rural area, but her doctor still considered MS to be a white woman's disease. This particular scenario occurred a few years ago, but this was not a layperson's understanding of MS. It was a physician's. Does this sort of bias still get in the way of diagnosing MS in minority populations?
Absolutely. So there's a lot of education that needs to be done. I was very fortunate to work with one of our industry partners to create a series of programs or co-create a series of programs focused on MS in the Black community that didn't involve any medications. And so it was very interesting when I would go door to door, so to speak, to speak with many of the community neurologists. It was really news to them that the incidence of MS is highest in Black people and that African Americans were at higher risk. And so I think that although this information may be common within the MS specialist community, there's still a lot of work to be done to reach the masses. And the majority of people with MS are being cared for by general neurologists. So it's crucial that we get that information out there so that people can be diagnosed and treated earlier.
Speaking of creating programs, when I introduced you, I forgot to mention that you are launching a new podcast. Why don't you tell us about it and tell us where we can find it?
Absolutely. So I'm launching a new podcast that will be kind of a spinoff of a Facebook Live series that I am doing in conjunction with BlackDoctor.org called Brain Chat with the Nerdy Neurologist. I hope to get to John's status one day. I hope to get to your status. But focused on different topics. So, you know, we'll have scientific topics where I have, you know, certain MS specialists and other specialists talk about things specific to MS. We'll also talk about patient advocacy, things like creating your own space and letting your voice be heard and the importance of, you know, telling your story with MS. So I'm really excited about it. So it's every other Monday. So the next one will be on March 8th on Facebook Live on the BlackDoctor.org Facebook page, as well as their YouTube page. And then the podcast will be on Spotify the following week after the Facebook Live is done.
Well, I can only say that in order to reach my status, you'll have to forget an awful lot about what you know about multiple sclerosis, okay? Well, more seriously, you know, it's difficult to fix something until you can clearly see what the problem really is. And Dr. Mitzi Joy Williams, thank you for all the work you do to shine a bright light on the obstacles and barriers that members of underserved minority populations still have to overcome in order to access quality MS care. I'm hopeful that having these conversations today will make them unnecessary in the future. And I want to thank you for talking with me today.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure, John. Thank you so much for inviting me.
This second conversation that I want to reshare with you is with the CEO and the Chief Medical Officer at Abata Therapeutics, a biotech startup that's working on a novel cell therapy for treating progressive MS. This therapy is designed to stop inflammation, and it may in fact set the stage for remyelination to occur. Abata seems to check all the boxes when you think about taking the best and brightest and putting them to work on solving progressive MS. You know, I don't get to use the term transformational often, and I don't use it lightly. But Abata is working on what has to be considered a transformational therapy for progressive MS. I was excited to learn about their therapy, and I'm excited to see where their work takes them in the coming year. In a moment, we'll hear a replay of my conversation with Samantha Singer and Dr. Richard Rantzelhoff. Just a few weeks ago, life sciences company Abata Therapeutics came out of stealth mode and made a high-profile announcement that it was taking on progressive MS by targeting regulatory T cells. With me to talk about Abata's plans are the president and CEO of Abata Therapeutics, Samantha Singer, and Dr. Richard Rantzelhoff, one of the company's co-founders, as well as its chief medical officer. And while Abata Therapeutics is a new venture, this is very familiar territory for Dr. Rantzelhoff, who spent 30 years at the Cleveland Clinic, where he founded and directed the Neuroinflammation Research Center and the Lerner Research Institute. In 2012, Dr. Rantzelhoff was named the recipient of the National MS Society's John Distel Prize for Multiple Sclerosis Research for his pioneering work in MS that led to new insights on immune activity in the brain and spinal cord. Richard, Samantha, welcome to the podcast and congratulations on the unveiling of Abata Therapeutics.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on the podcast with you. So delighted you want to hear about what we're doing.
Absolutely. I think this is really exciting news. And Dr. Rantzelhoff, maybe I can start with you. A lot of our listeners are familiar with B cells, as many of them are on B cell depleting therapies, but they may not be as familiar with the role of T cells. Can you help us understand what regulatory T cells are and how your treatment is designed to work?
Yes, I can give it a go, let's say. So T cells are white blood cells, which are regarded as the conductors of the immune system orchestra. So they, in effect, tell the other cells what to do, including the B cells and a whole variety of other cells that help protect us from infection, but can also be involved in autoimmunity, meaning an attack against the body's own tissues, as we see in multiple sclerosis. The great majority of the T cells are specially adapted to fight against infection, and therefore they're involved in attacking things. A very small but crucial population of cells, maybe only 5% of all the T cells, are involved in helping to dampen down the inflammation and make sure it doesn't get out of control. Those are called regulatory T cells, and anybody who is, I guess, probably old enough to remember governors on hot rods would be familiar with what they do. So what regulatory T cells do is control the immune attack so it does not damage the body's own tissues while it is clear, while infection is being cleared. And our goal at Abata is to take these remarkable cells and use them for the treatment of autoimmune disease. We're beginning with progressive MS because so far there have not been good treatments developed specifically for progressive MS.
And where do these T cells that are going to be used in the treatment, where do they come from?
Oh, great question. Thank you. Yeah, this is meant to be, in a way, very natural therapy. So the person who is being treated with these regulatory T cells will donate a quantity of blood, and we will take their own regulatory T cells. For the MS treatment, we will modify the T cells, the regulatory T cells specifically, so that they can enter the brain area and dampen inflammation specifically in the brain. We will then give them some growth factors and some other substances that are going to promote their health and function. So we will expand their numbers, and then we will give the person's own cells back to them, but modified so they can go to the brain and fight inflammation.
And as these T cells go to the brain and address, take on inflammation, is there also any opportunity or potential there for any repair?
Again, a really great question. Regulatory T cells are found in every tissue of the body, and every one of these populations of regulatory T cells is very highly adapted to function optimally in that tissue. The regulatory T cells that we will put back into the person have not been changed so that they have a brain-specific function, but when they go into the brain, they receive signals that modify their function and enable them to make repair factors specifically for myelin. This possibility has been borne out through very nice experiments performed by a group primarily at Cambridge University in the UK, where damage to myelin could be repaired under the influence of regulatory T cells.
I guess my initial response is, wow. Samantha, when it comes to this process, in order to deliver this treatment, I understand that while every step of the process has been successfully executed before, all the steps have never been executed together. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, one of the things that gives us confidence that we can develop this therapy is that each step along the way has been done in some context. We're also building on all the technology and experience that's happened in the oncology field, where cell therapies have really taken off and had a huge impact. So we've got a nice foundation to build on. But, you know, creating a therapy is different from doing experiments in a lab. Right. And so that's really where we come in, you know, taking what people have done before and, you know, creating a process that does what Richard describes from vein to vein for the patient, you know, taking their own cells, you know, harnessing their native strengths and capabilities and administering them back as a therapy. So we're going to do that execution work to convert what's happened before into something that can be an approved therapy.
I should also share with my listeners that Abata Therapeutics has received $95 million in Series A funding to develop cell therapies for MS and other autoimmune diseases. I believe that represents the single largest private equity investment in developing an MS therapy that's ever been made. And this novel approach that Abata is pursuing could result in just a transformational treatment for people living with progressive MS. Samantha, you've said that Abata cell therapy for MS will be in the clinic by the end of 2025. That sounds like an ambitious timetable, so I'm sure your team has a lot to do. What are your next steps?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, our key next steps are to, you know, identify that ideal T cell receptor. So this is the actual receptor that recognizes an antigen that turns it on, you know, in the brain, as Richard described. And so we want to, you know, discover that component that we'll engineer into the cells. And then the second piece is, you know, working to develop that process end to end of manufacturing the cells. And we have a partner named Elevate Bio that we have a collaboration with. They have a tremendous amount of experience and innovation in cell and gene therapy. And so we're quite confident that they'll be a wonderful partner in getting us into the clinic on that kind of a timescale.
Well, Abata's novel approach to treating progressive MS is really exciting. And I'm hoping we can circle back with you as your team hits its milestones and you have news to share.
Yep, absolutely. We'd be delighted to come back and share more as we progress.
Well, Samantha Singer, Dr. Richard Ranselhoff, best of luck as you gear up for this ambitious undertaking in delivering a novel cell therapy for progressive MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you so much. Your questions were great, and we're really delighted to share what we intend to do with you and your listeners.
Thank you very much. And thank you to listeners for all their interest. We want to change lives, and we're going to work hard to get this therapy into patients.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/225. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. And if you find yourself with some extra free time this week, you might want to catch up on your Real Talk MS listening. And the easiest way to do that is through the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. So if you haven't yet gotten around to it, please visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the Real Talk MS app. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes, and it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. So I hope you'll take a moment and download the app today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and happy holidays.